I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, hoo boy, this is an episode that I said I would never do. Namely, an episode on the Kennedy assassination. Now, I've had guests on who have talked peripherally about the assassination, but for me, I don't know enough about the subject, and it just seems like a quagmire. There's so much debate around it, from both people who believe that Oswald did it and people who think there was more to it and that the Warren Commission didn't give the full story. I gotta be honest, I really don't have a strong opinion. I do, however, have an interest in matters related to JFK and foreign policy and Vietnam, so I had some guests on the show to discuss matters related to that. A while back, however, Fred Litwin, the author of On the Trail of Delusion, contacted me and asked if I would host him on my program. His book deals with the Jim Garrison investigation in New Orleans of Clay Shaw, which linked Shaw and other individuals to the assassination of President Kennedy. Fred Litwin is very critical of the sort of conspiratorial view of the assassination, and after mulling it over, I said, sure, I love having guests on, and I just enjoy talking to people. I had initially wanted him to come on and maybe debate some of the other guests I've had on that take a different view of the Kennedy assassination, but that didn't really work out. So we did this interview. Now, since I had originally planned a sort of debate format, there was a person involved in the JFK research community that knew that I was doing this interview with Litwin, and they asked that they be given a forum to respond to what Litwin had to say in the course of our conversation. I felt that it was only fair that I obliged. Of course, in doing all of this, I have to say, I'm just not an expert on the Kennedy assassination, and I have to say, I kind of wish that I had trusted my gut instinct to not cover the assassination directly on this program, but sometimes you gotta go against your instincts. Is what it is. Anyways, this is my conversation with Fred Litwin. He provides a view of the assassination that basically lines up, I would say, with the quote-unquote official narrative. And he has a lot to say about Jim Garrison. Now, I didn't really take issue with a lot of what Fred said because, again, I don't know enough about the assassination itself. I do think that there is a little bit more conversation to be had about the issue of JFK foreign policy in Vietnam, and that the issue of JFK conspiracy theories and how much they've influenced QAnon and the right wing is a bit more complicated, and I do disagree with Fred on that in particular, but I don't hold any ill will towards him, and I hope this conversation was, you know, pretty impartial and fair. So, without further ado, after that long-winded intro, here's my conversation with Fred Litwin, author of On the Trail of Delusion. Washington, D.C. Place of stately discourse.
Beer knuckle politics and all other assorted forms of scandal. You want the dirt on the Capitol? Then check out Washington Babylon. Shocking true stories and political sleaze, edited by Ken Silverstein. WashingtonBabylon.com.
Welcome to Parallax Views, Fred Litwin, author of On the Trail of Delusion, Jim Garrison, the Great Accuser. This is a book about the Kennedy assassination and the conspiracy theories around it. I sort of promised myself when I started recording this show that I would not touch on the Kennedy assassination. I always have viewed it as a bit of a quagmire. But I'm going to make an exception, and I think we're going to have an interesting conversation. So how are you doing today?
I'm great. Great. Thank you for having me. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. So what led you to write a book about the Kennedy assassination? Or I guess this is the second one, right?
This is my second one. And actually, the funny thing is that both books are really not about the Kennedy assassination. They're more about conspiracy theory and the Kennedy assassination. The first book, I was a teenage JFK conspiracy freak. I wrote that a couple of years ago, and it was really trying to tell people why I moved from believing in conspiracy to not believing in conspiracy. It's funny because one of the reviewers on Amazon, who I know in Dallas, said, oh, it's a great book, but there's almost nothing in there on the assassination, which is quite true. This book, On the Trail of Delusion, I wrote in reply to a critic of one of my books on the web and said, well, you really haven't gone through Garrison's documents. You haven't gone through any of the new documents from the Assassinations Record Review Board. And so I started going through all those documents. And as I went through them, I started finding crazy memo after crazy memo. And after you find 30 or 40 crazy Garrison memos, you realize he was crazier than I thought. Maybe it's time for a book.
So for my listeners who may be unfamiliar, who was Jim Garrison?
Jim Garrison was the district attorney of New Orleans in the 1960s. He was elected in 1962, and he served until 1973. He was a sort of a populist of his time. He was 6 feet seven, 6 feet eight. He was very tall, good looking, booming voice, very smart. He could think on his feet. He had a great sense of humor. He was very well read. And he was very ambitious. And so when he took office, he started going after people. He started going after the police, the courts, the judges, the legislature. He had a variety of political opponents. And every battle he fought, he won, making him a very powerful politician in New Orleans, or in Louisiana, I should say. And in 1966, in the summer, fall of 1966, there was conspiracy fever in the states with Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment coming out in September 66, and a whole slew of other assassination books. And Garrison started reading them, and he was kind of bored. And he realized that Lee Harvey Oswald lived in New Orleans for 5 months prior to the assassination. And he felt, hey, if there's a conspiracy, maybe it was incubated, maybe it was started in New Orleans. And so he went down the rabbit hole to investigate the assassination.
So you mentioned Mark Lane, that Rush to Judgment book, Rush to Judgment. I think it even produced at one point a movie version. I think it was called Executive Action with Burt Lancaster. What was the sort of theory behind that book, and then maybe we can get into Garrison's initial theories about the assassination. I guess, more generally, what is the sort of conspiracy theory that is most talked about when it comes to the Kennedy assassination?
Well, Mark Lane was an early sort of hanger-oner. I mean, he basically realized there was an opportunity to use the JFK assassination as a vehicle for publicity, and he immediately went to Dallas. He wrote a long op-ed, a long piece for the National Guardian, which was an extreme left-wing newspaper in New York, basically arguing that sort of for Oswald's innocence, but basically asking a lot of questions about what's going on. And that led him to becoming the attorney for Lee Harvey Oswald's mother. So she hired him, and that was a great ticket because that got him a lot of publicity and a huge opening, and he started going around the country to college campuses criticizing the Warren reports, which came out in September 1964, and that ultimately led to a book. And so it's sort of his book is basically a defense brief for Oswald. It doesn't really argue for sort of any conspiracy theory, but it says the Warren report got it all wrong. There were multiple shooters. Don't know who was involved in the conspiracy, but Lee Harvey Oswald might quite possibly have been innocent. And that was the spawn. That was the start of many, many books coming out in the mid-60s about the assassination.
So what's the most popular theory of the Kennedy assassination? For people that don't know about the whole sort of field of, I guess, researchers and people who believe there was a conspiracy, what's the sort of most popular one? Because there's a million and one Kennedy assassination conspiracies.
Well, and I would say the most, first off, I mean, the most popular thing to believe is that there was at least two gunmen, one firing from the front, one firing in the back, and the Kennedy was quite possibly hit in the head twice. So there's a physical element of conspiracy in more than one gunman. I would say the most popular conspiracy theories revolve around the CIA, the military-industrial complex, and perhaps a bit of anti-Castro Cubans. And if you remember back in the 1960s, early 60s, the CIA was working with the mob and anti-Castro Cubans to assassinate Fidel Castro. So the concept of this sort of rogue elements working together was already there. And the fact that they could then feed back from Castro onto Kennedy was a very, very popular conspiracy theory.
And I guess there's also this idea that Kennedy wanted to end the war in Vietnam. I know there's evidence that he would, I think he went back and forth on the question of U.S. involvement in Vietnam. Could you explain that a little bit?
Well, that's a theory that actually started with Jim Garrison, that in fact Kennedy was killed because of his foreign policy, that he wanted to withdraw from Vietnam. He wanted to end the Cold War, and that was not possible according to the military-industrial complex. He had to be killed. The reality, of course, is quite different. Kennedy was a Cold Warrior through and through. And in fact, his speech that day in Dallas that he never gave was bragging about the increases to his military budget and bragging about all a variety of new weapon systems that was coming on board. On Vietnam, the record is that he clearly was weary of American involvement. He saw what happened to the French. But he also was facing an implacable foe in the Russians and the Chinese and North Vietnamese. We don't know what would have happened. He had plans to withdraw 1,000 troops by 1965, but only if the South Vietnamese army was good enough in its training to take over from American advisors. Of course, that would be debatable. And we certainly don't know if he would have accelerated the war like Lyndon Johnson did.
So in regards to Garrison, is there any more background information you can give my listeners regarding his early sort of political career? Because I've always found it interesting. I feel like there's no talk of Garrison before the Clay Shaw trial at all.
Well, it's a very interesting story. So he was an assistant district attorney working in the DA's office and decided at the last minute that he would run for the district attorney in 1961. But he was sort of an outsider and he sort of put some friends together, sort of started a no-nothing group. And in those days, Louisiana and certainly New Orleans was a Democratic area, so that you had to win the primary. If you won the Democratic primary, you were assured of winning election. And so that was his goal, to win the Democratic primary. And he was up against Richard Dowling, who was the current DA. And he was up actually against Irvin Diamond, who went on to become Clay Shaw's trial attorney. And Garrison, what Garrison really did well in that campaign was he spent most of his money on ads, television ads. And on the television, he was quite striking. He did a number of really good advertisements that he himself wrote that really caught people's imagination. And he had a great voice. And he ran those right at the end of the campaign. And he won election. And it was quite surprising, the Democratic establishment of the city. And being a very ambitious man, I think he wanted to be governor or perhaps senator from Louisiana. He basically started to go after people. And he literally was almost like every couple of months there would be a new target. He went after all the judges in New Orleans. He accused the judges of taking a lot of holidays, that they weren't working on Fridays. And, you know, and he made all these jokes about how they didn't work, and it caused a lot of scorn for the judges. What he didn't tell people was that back then the judges did not have any assistants. And so they would spend their Fridays in the library researching their cases. But truth is another matter to Garrison. But he systematically went after everybody. He went after the police. He went after the judges. He went after the legislature. He went after the bail bondsman. He went after the parole board. He just had every target after target. And he generated a lot of headlines, which New Orleans, citizens in New Orleans liked being entertained. It was a lot of fun, and that made him very, very popular.
And he also went after what's the I'm blanking on it now. Beer drinkers, I think, or
well, he went after vice. So like a lot of district attorneys, he went after vice. And in fact, what I found in the Times-Picayune was a joint statement from Garrison's office and the police, in which they listed their targets for their vice campaign. So number one was bee drinkers. This is basically where you go into a bar and you have these female cocktail hostesses who are serving you drinks, and they basically get you drunk, take all your money, don't give you the right change, and they kick people out. But amongst the targets were also homosexuals and a variety of other targets. So he had many, many targets, and he started a vice campaign, and he shut down some bars on Bourbon Street, to great publicity. And so he was known as sort of a reformer. At the same time, he had all these political opponents. Of course, that didn't last. It didn't, but he was famous for it.
So how, beyond just reading Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment, how does the ball really get rolling to where this Clay Shaw trial happens? And maybe you can tell my listeners first who Clay Shaw is, because I have some younger listeners that may be unfamiliar.
Well, before I get to Clay Shaw, I mean, Mark Lane and others really had got the whole population up in a whirlwind about the assassination. It was very, very much a big thing in the fall of 66 and the winter of 67. So Garrison was not immune to that. He felt the opinion polls, he felt this interest in the assassination. There were two leads in New Orleans. Back from 1963, the Garrison actually investigated himself for the FBI or with the FBI and the Warren Commission. And so he decided to go back to these two leads. The first lead was a lawyer in New Orleans by the name of Dean Andrews. And he basically testified that on the weekend of the assassination, he was in the hospital suffering from double pneumonia. And he claimed that he got a phone call from a Mr. Clay Bertrand, who called him on the Saturday to go to Dallas and perhaps represent Lee Harvey Oswald, the Oswald's attorney. And so the question was, who was this Mr. Bertrand? The FBI wanted to know. They interviewed Dean Andrews at the time. He said that Mr. Bertrand was around 22 years old, 5'7", blonde hair. But then he sort of admitted, well, you know, I was under heavy sedation. Maybe I made this up. I'm not really too sure. He was a jive-talking, fun-loving, jazz-loving, heavy-set lawyer. You never could tell when he was really telling the truth. But he did testify before the Warren Commission, and he revived his testimony about Clay Bertrand, but he changed the physical description of him. So that was one lead. Who was this Clay Bertrand? The second lead in New Orleans revolved around a pilot by the name of David Ferry. He was a pilot for Eastern Airlines in the early 60s, and he was dismissed because he had an underage boy in the cockpit with him flying back to New Orleans from, I think, Houston. He was gay, homosexual, which was not a good thing, and he had a predilection for teenage boys. And
when you say weekend, not a good thing, you mean not a good thing in the eyes of like,
yeah,
the
not
society.
A good thing in the eyes of the police, of course, and the DA and everybody else. It was pretty taboo. I should say I'm gay myself. But on the weekend of the on that Friday, David Ferry was in court. He was working for an attorney who was working for Carlos Marcello. Marcello was in court. They won that case. The case wrapped up around 3:30 in the afternoon. And David Ferry, with two young fellows who were around in their 18 years old, they drove from New Orleans to Houston that weekend, and they went ice skating on Saturday and drove back on Sunday. And so the question was, what happened on this trip? Why was David Ferry going to Houston? And there was one of his mortal enemies in New Orleans that weekend called the intelligence division of the New Orleans Police Department to say that Ferry was quite suspicious. He was an instructor in the Civil Air Patrol in the 1950s, and Oswald was one of his students. And Ferry was known to like rifles, and perhaps he had taught Oswald how to use a rifle. So he was brought in for questioning when he came back from his trip. His whereabouts were confirmed, and he was ultimately let go. So that was the second lead for Garrison. First one was Clay Bertrand. Who was he? And the second lead was David Ferry. So that's where it stood. So Garrison went back into reinvestigating those two leads, and it really went nowhere. Dean Andrews would not tell him who Mr. Bertrand was, and David Ferry, who he talked to, was quite adamant. We just went ice skating that weekend. I have nothing to do with anything. But the question for Garrison was, maybe he could figure out on his own who this Clay Bertrand was. And it sort of came to him because he knew that Clay Bertrand was gay because he represented some gay kids as well. He spoke Spanish and he had the first name Clay. And he figured out maybe it was Clay Shaw, who was a gay businessman in New Orleans who also spoke Spanish. And he just suspected maybe it was Clay Shaw. And that's how Clay Shaw came on the radar for Jim Garrison.
When you say he knew that Clay Bertrand was gay because he represented some gay clients, are you referring to a concept that comes in this book that apparently Garrison liked called propinquity, right?
Well, yeah, and that was part that ultimately was part of it. I mean, propinquity came into play. Propinquity was a term coined by Garrison. It's a lovely word, propinquity. Not that many people use it. Propinquity means basically looking for coincidences. It could be addresses. So if you lived on a certain block and a suspect lived on the same block, then somehow you were connected. And he felt by looking at these connections that people would slip up and some truth would emerge. And so if a homosexual was involved, then he would look at other homosexuals. Propinquity always played a big role in Garrison's investigation. It was a crazy theory, and I have some amazing memos that I dug up on propinquity. Propinquity came into play, of course, once he suspected Clay Shaw. David Ferry was gay. Clay Shaw was gay. Garrison's big breakthrough was to meld the two stories, the Clay Shaw story and the David Ferry story, into one story. And that led to other gay people as well.
So I want to stick on this propinquity concept for a second. Is there a way we could differentiate this from And I was thinking about how to ask this before the show. So I'll put it this way. I think at times it is good to look at different people's connections, right? Whether it be maybe a person like Roger Stone or a Clinton person like Sidney Blumenthal, because you can look at their connections, maybe who's funding them, and, you know, it can give you an idea of maybe what agenda they have or what line they're pushing. Would you say that that's different from what Garrison was doing?
Yeah, it's very important to look at connections for sure. What he was doing was basically saying, okay, you know, Oswald lived on the 4900 block of Magazine Street. And so you would get out a directive, who else lives on that block? And so everybody else became a suspect, and he would investigate everybody on that block. Now, okay, fine. I get maybe some of those people might know something because they might have seen Oswald. But he would go one step further. So he would say, well, you know, a friend of Clay Shaw's, Leighton Martin's, he is an uncle who lives on 4900 block. So therefore, there's a connection between Leighton Martin's and Oswald. And so this, it starts to get meaningless because you're so far removed from any sort of meaningful connection. And he would do that all the time and write up memo after memo after memo of looking at connections.
In other words, you know, it's like casting a ridiculously wide net.
Yeah, it's sort of 6 degrees of separation. And so, you know, I'll give you another example. In 1962, there was a party in Jefferson Parish, a gay party, and 96 homosexuals were arrested. So that was in 62. So in 1967, Garrison got out that list of gay people who were arrested and said, well, is there anybody interesting there who might be connected to Clay Shaw? And he looked through that list and he circled every one of Clay Shaw's friends, who, and there were some, who were arrested at that party. But where do you go with that? What does that tell you? Okay, some of his friends might have been arrested at a gay party in 1962, but where do you go? What do you do with that information?
Yeah, it's interesting because I almost think that this idea of propinquity has become, it's become triumphant in our age because, you know, I mean, when we talk about something like either QAnon or Russiagate, and I think there is elements of people who talk about Russiagate that take it a lot farther than, you know, the sort of mainstream analysis of it. And a lot of it is based on both in the QAnon world and in those fringe elements of the Russiagate world. It is based on this sort of 6 degrees of separation. It's sort of become a norm in a lot of our society now.
Yeah, and I think it plays a huge part in a lot of conspiracy theories about, you know, you're a suspect because you're adjacent to somebody else who is a suspect. And so it's pretty common. We could thank Garrison for putting a lot of that into action.
So what's the fallout from that? What damage did this sort of idea of propinquity and this approach that Garrison had have on people?
Well, I mean, once Clay Shaw was a suspect, and David Ferry was a suspect. David Ferry unfortunately died of a Berry aneurysm right after the news of his investigation came public. But you sort of had, he was a homosexual, and Clay Shaw was a homosexual, and then this guy Perry Russo came forward, who was also gay, who knew David Ferry. And so to Garrison, it was like, oh, this guy's gay, this guy's gay, this guy's gay. And then he started seeing a homosexual conspiracy, because then he talked himself into believing that Lee Harvey Oswald was gay. Oswald was gay. Jack Ruby was gay. And J.D. Tippit was gay. And you have six gay people involved in the assassination. So it's a homosexual conspiracy. And then it was, the question for him was, well, what is driving this homosexual conspiracy? And that, of course, led him into some really crazy thinking, until I think people like Mark Lane and others talked him out of it. He said, hold it, you can't, this is too crazy for us. You've got to change your thinking.
I was going to mention, there are some of these early critics of the Warren Commission that took strong issue, I guess, with Garrison even early on. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so when Garrison announced his investigation in February of 1967, there were a number of Warren Commission critics who went down to New Orleans. So Vincent Salandria, Mort Saul, Mark Lane, Harold Weisberg all made the trip down to New Orleans to help Garrison. Edward J. Epstein went. But there was one critic who did not go, and that was Sylvia Marr. Sylvia Marr lived in New York City. She wished Garrison well, and she actually wrote him a couple of letters offering her support. But it didn't take long before she started having her doubts and problems with Garrison's investigation. And I went to the Sylvia Marr archives at Hood College in Maryland, and I have an awful lot of her letters. And it caused a rift between her and the other critics, because she said, look, I don't support the Warren Commission. I don't support it because they use some faulty reasoning in a variety of areas. Garrison is doing the exact same thing. So how come you can't see it? I can see it. This man is a charlatan. How could you support this? And it caused an awful rift between her and the other critics.
What were her sort of critiques of Garrison and his approach to the JFK assassination?
Well, she really saw right after the preliminary hearing in March 1967, she realized that Perry Russo was the main witness against Clay Shaw. Perry Russo had been subject to sodium pentothal and then hypnotized three times, at which point he remembered a meeting at which Clay Shaw was present with Lee Harvey Oswald, and they discussed the assassination. It was a recovered memory. And Sylvia Marr could see right through that. She felt that this testimony is not believable. The other witness that Garrison had in March 67 was Vernon Bundy, who was a heroin addict, who claimed that he saw Oswald and Shaw talking at Lake Pontchartrain while Bundy was in the process of shooting up heroin. And she felt that was unbelievable too. And so she said, you know, she said to fellow critics, you critics who bring skepticism to every witness the Warren Commission brings forward, why are you not critical of these witnesses? They seem even more suspect. And she never wavered from her criticisms of Jim Garrison.
You mentioned recovered memory. Does that relate to like hypnosis and all the stuff that we sort of heard about more about in the 1980s with the whole satanic panic?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Perry Russo, after David Ferry died, Perry Russo, who was living in Baton Rouge, called the newspapers and he called the TV reporters in Baton Rouge. And he said, I knew David Ferry. And in fact, David Ferry had talked about, you know, getting rid of Kennedy. And so he was interviewed on TV and on the press in New Orleans, in Baton Rouge. And he wrote a letter to Jim Garrison. And Garrison sent one of his investigators, Andrew Chambra, to interview Perry Russo. And Perry Russo sort of repeated the story, but he also told Chambra, perhaps if you hypnotize me, I could remember more. He didn't remember all that much. And so he was brought to New Orleans, and he was given sodium pentothal. And then after that, he was hypnotized three times. We have the transcripts of two of those hypnosis sessions. One session, we do not have the transcript. Supposedly, he regressed too far back and was unsuccessful. But basically, a memory was implanted that he all of a sudden remembered a party at David Ferry's house in which Oswald attended, and so did Clay Shaw, and they discussed the assassination of JFK.
Now, I also wanted to mention, you mentioned Harold Weisberg. Did he also end up having issues with Garrison?
Yeah, Weisberg went down to New Orleans, and he was did a lot of work there. He wrote one of his books, Oswald Oswald and the CIA in New Orleans. He wrote a lot of memos to Garrison. He was there off and on. He lived, of course, in Maryland, near Washington, D.C. But ultimately, after a while, he started to sort of like see through Jim Garrison, and he became he was a critic in the early 1970s. But he really became a critic when Oliver Stone's film came out. And he was really horrified by what Oliver Stone had done, and wrote a lot of memos, which I went through in his archives, about both the Oliver Stone film JFK and the Jim Garrison investigation.
Now, before we get into the bigger picture, and I guess the elements of this book that aren't there is a bigger picture here than just the assassination. And I want to get into that, but there's two other figures I wanted to touch upon. The first is a very interesting fellow by the name of Cary Thornley, who helped found the Discordian Society, which was sort of a prank religion, and also knew Lee Harvey Oswald. Tell us a little bit more about Cary Thornley and how he ends up getting, you know, involved in this whole case.
So Cary Thornley volunteered for the Marines, and basically while Lee Harvey Oswald was exiting the Marines in California, Cary Thornley was entering the Marines in California, and they crossed paths for a couple of months. And Thornley noticed, or Oswald noticed, that Thornley was an atheist, and that attracted Oswald, and they started to discuss politics. Oswald was a Marxist. He was getting Russian newspapers, but he found Thornley as sort of somebody that he could talk to about some of these political theories. Although they didn't talk that much, but they talked a bit. Thornley then shipped off to Japan. Oswald left the Marines. But Thornley sort of came up with a concept for writing a book, and he wanted to write a book about people who were served in the U.S. military, but who were somewhat disillusioned with what the military was doing. And so he wanted to call, he sort of tentatively called his book The Idle Warriors. And Oswald was one of the people that he was sort of basing his main character on. He started writing the book, and then Oswald defected to the Soviet Union. And that, of course, really changed Thornley. He had to really change his book somewhat. So he was fascinated with Oswald, and he was writing this book. And he also lived in New Orleans for a couple of weeks. He overlapped with Oswald in September 1963. They were both in New Orleans. And Garrison, through David Lifton, who is another JFK critic, basically Lifton brought Thornley to the attention of Jim Garrison. And they came with an idea of using Thornley to sort of look at another ex-Marine and perhaps force some testimony out of somebody else. And ultimately, Thornley became a suspect to Jim Garrison, and Garrison indicted him for perjury. And it's a quite of a funny story in my book.
It's interesting, too, because I wanted to get into what happens to Cary Thornley after this is all said and done, because I think it does point towards some of the problems of conspiratorial thinking and what it can do to people.
You know, look, there's a lot of people in a variety of conspiracy cases that may be peripherally involved as a character or a suspect, but then who they themselves get caught up in conspiracy fever. Another one was Jack Ruby. Jack Ruby, I find it funny, in 1965, when he was examined by a new psychiatrist in preparation for his appeal of his conviction for killing Lee Harvey Oswald, the psychiatrist asked Jack Ruby if there was a conspiracy to kill JFK. And he said there was. There was a conspiracy. And he said, you know, I'll tell you all about the conspiracy. I have this book that I've been reading that I borrowed from another inmate here in jail. He had been reading Thomas Buchanan's book, Who Killed Kennedy? And so Jack Ruby got all his information about a supposed conspiracy from one of the books. And so the same thing with Cary Thornley. There he was being accused of Jim Garrison of knowing Lee Harvey Oswald, knowing a variety of other characters in New Orleans. And the more he thought about it, the more he thought about all of this stuff, the more he believed that maybe I did meet Clay Shaw once, remodeling my house. Maybe I did come in contact with Guy Bannister. And all of a sudden, before you know it, he's becoming a conspiracy theorist, and he's sort of believing all sorts of strange things about different conspiracies. He really himself went down the rabbit hole.
Well, I think he came to believe that he was like an MK Ultra, like Manchurian candidate.
Yeah, he believed that there were, it's all in my book. It was so crazy. I had to quote from some other people who had written about some of his strange beliefs about lizard people and stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah. It's definitely an interesting story, and it gets weirder from there. I guess there's also a UFO connection to this.
Who would have thought there'd be a UFO connection to Jim Garrison? But one of the strangest suspects in the Jim Garrison saga is a man by the name of Fred Chrisman. Fred Chrisman lived in Washington State, sort of Tacoma, and he was involved in the 1940s in a UFO prank, or should I say a flying saucer prank, before they were called UFOs. But it was Kenneth Arnold who started the whole flying saucer craze, I think, in 1947.
Maury Island.
Well, before Maury Island, there was the whole sighting in Palmer or whatever, so sighted these flying saucers. But then, well, Fred Chrisman was working for – was that, do you want me to start with Fred Chrisman?
Yeah.
So he was working at Puget Sound for sort of harvesting lumber, and he made up this story about seeing these flying saucers, and the flying saucers emitted a strange substance which killed his dog and tumbled some trees, and basically this was an attempt to become famous. The problem for Fred Chrisman was that once word of this flying saucer sighting came out, then Kenneth Arnold, who was involved in the first flying saucer sighting, flew out to investigate. And he talked the Air Force into sending out two investigators who flew out to investigate. They realized it was a fraud. There was nothing there. There was no strange substance. They were looking at some volcanic ash. But unfortunately, those two investigators, when flying back to where they came from, their plane crashed. And they were both killed. And so the FBI came in to investigate. And the question was, do you prosecute Fred Chrisman for a fraud? But they decided not to. They thought this was all an accident and nothing to prosecute him. So he was involved in this crazy, this sort of flying saucer fraud. But that's who he was. He was a bit of a fraudster himself, a con man who liked to come up with all sorts of stories about he would forge these degrees. His whole life was sort of a con man. And somebody wrote an anonymous letter to Jim Garrison saying that you should look into this guy, Fred Chrisman. In fact, there were two anonymous letters naming Fred Chrisman, and that got Garrison interested. Fred Chrisman was sent a subpoena to appear before the New Orleans grand jury. Garrison sent him money and a plane ticket, and he came. He knew nothing, of course. At the time of the assassination, Chrisman was a high school teacher, and he was in class, and nothing ever happened. But after Garrison was finished, he continued to think of Chrisman as a suspect, and he wrote several memos to the House Select Committee on Assassinations on Fred Chrisman.
Yeah, I'm interested. What do you think about, do you think that's a reoccurring theme with sort of conspiracy culture, where you have these sort of con men in the background? I mean, there's people that I would openly call con men and fraud artists, like, there was an FBI agent, Ted Gunderson, who was basically just an ambulance chaser involved with the Satanic Panic. And it seems like these con men really take advantage of conspiratorial thinking.
Yeah, look, you know, as you go through the Garrison files, there were an awful lot of prisoners who would write Garrison and say, look, you got to come down to my prison and interview me. I have some very, very big information, and you know, perhaps you would spring me and get me out. There's even people who, one of my favorite letters is he went down he sent his people to interview one prisoner. They came back, and the prisoner wrote a second letter saying, well, I have more to tell. Come back. I've got a lot more to tell. So he was inundated with people who were contacting him with information. But the con men, and there was another con man by the name of Thomas Beckham, who was an even bigger con man than Fred Chrisman. And in fact, they worked together. And Beckham was a master at forging university degrees and professional credentials. And Garrison thought he was also a suspect. And I guess they wanted their name in the papers. They wanted some publicity, and they got it. But there was nothing to it. But Garrison never wavered from looking at them as conspirators.
It's interesting, too, because until I read this book, I did not know that there was a connection. I don't know if it's connection, but there's this character that Garrison's looking into called Edgar Bradley. And Garrison, I guess, steps into a feud that Bradley is having with, of all groups, the right-wing sort of fringe John Birch Society. What happened with that?
Well, out in Southern California, there was sort of a melange of extreme right-wing groups. There was the National States Rights Party, There was the John Birch Society. There was the Minutemen. There was the KKK. So there was a variety of, and people were in one or more of these groups, and there were meetings, and they sort of knew each other. And like any sort of groupings of people, there were feuds. And so one young guy wrote Garrison a letter saying, "You got to come out to California. There's this guy, Edgar Eugene Bradley, that we know, and he's involved in the assassination. He tried to hire somebody to kill Kennedy back when he was running for the Democratic primary in 1960. Come out and we have all this information."
This is a Bircher contacting them.
Yeah, this is a Bircher, extreme right winger. And basically Garrison was in L.A. and he had a couple of his investigators with them. And he said, "You know what, you guys go out and talk to these people." And they went out and talked to these people. And basically it was a feud. And it was a feud between the woman, Carol Idelot, who was having a feud with Edgar Eugene Bradley. And so she figured a good way to get back at Bradley was basically to sick Garrison on him. And she told Garrison all these stories about how he's involved in the JFK assassination. And Garrison believed it. And he indicted Bradley for conspiring to kill Kennedy. And, you know, it made Bradley's life not that easy. You have to hire a lawyer. You have to go through an extradition proceedings. But fortunately for Bradley, Garrison couldn't produce any evidence, and Ronald Reagan refused to have him extradited from California.
It's interesting because I think that's one of the most interesting things that come out of this book is, I remember when JFK came out, you can find these newspaper articles reviewing the movie, and there was a lot of concern over what was being called fusion paranoia at the time. A lot of people at places like the Post and the New York Times were complaining of fusion paranoia, which was like left and right wing sort of populists and ideologues sort of fusing these paranoid visions of America together. Do you think that's an issue that we still see today?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think you see it today and you see it back then. I mean, basically, one of the conspiracy theorists that Oliver Stone used in his movie was L. Fletcher Prouty. And Prouty was a former military man who was involved in a variety of operations. But he became a very, very big critic of what you would call today the deep state.
He called it the secret team.
He called it the secret team. And it was basically this melange of CIA, military, industrial men, the Defense Department, generals, who were all conspiring to basically engage the U.S. in foreign wars and foreign interactions that were not right. And it's the forerunner of what Trump would call the deep state. It's the exact same thing. So he was sort of a right-wing conspiracy theorist at the time that Oliver Stone had championed and put into his movie, and it melded quite well with left-wing conspiracy theories about the military-industrial complex and the CIA.
What made him sort of right-wing? Was he like an open Cold Warrior?
Well, what made him right-wing was he wasn't a sort of a socialist, an economic socialist or a socialist. He wasn't a hippie. He wasn't, he hung out with other military. He was sort of a military man. I mean, that's who his bearing was. And but it sort of came out of from the right of getting the U.S. involved in stuff that they shouldn't. And it was sort of a mirror image of the left. It was very similar to a left-wing thing, but he without the trappings of a left-wing economic critique of the economy.
And he also got involved, I guess, with Willis Cardo and the Liberty Lobby. Can you talk a little bit to that?
Yeah, so the Liberty Lobby, Willis Cardo started the Liberty Lobby, which was an anti-Semitic group. He thought the Jews were the number one enemy of the United States, and he started the Liberty Lobby, and Fletcher Prouty was on their radio show many times. He was on their political action committee board of directors. It was horrible that he was involved with all this, and when this came out during Oliver Stone's film, Oliver Stone said, well, it was a mistake on Prouty's part, but Prouty himself was not anti-Semitic. And of course, I unearthed the letter that L. Fletcher Prouty sent with a very clear anti-Semitic sentence in it.
Could you talk a little bit more about that letter?
Well, basically, it was a letter sent to somebody, and Crowdy was warning in the letter about the problem of military technology and the fact that you've got more and more technology that depends upon the ground, communication between the ground and fighter pilots, etc., communication systems. And the problem, as he said in his letter, is what if that person on the ground is a Jewish person? And so it was a pretty horrible letter, and I was pretty surprised when I found it.
It's interesting because I think Cardo himself was very sort of, how do I put this? He knew what he was doing with the Liberty Lobby. Like, it seemed to have been the plan to try to bring together right-wing and left-wing elements sort of against what he called the plutocracy. So there was, it seems like he was really taking advantage of, you know, both the left and the right to push his agendas.
Well, and I think the thing to remember about anti-Semitism is that it's hard. Anti-Semitism is a conspiracy theory. You know, racism is horrible, but racism against blacks means you want to avoid them wherever possible. They're bad people. I won't hire them. I don't want to be around them. That's awful. But anti-Semitism isn't that. It isn't, I don't want to be around Jews. It's, I can't avoid them. They control the banks. They control finance. They control Hollywood. They control the press. I can't avoid them. I have to do something. And that's when it turns murderous. So in and of itself, it's a conspiracy theory. And Cardo saw a conspiracy. I mean, you had all these, again, you had, whether it's right or the left, the Jews were involved.
So before we wrap up here, I want to get into that sort of bigger picture that I mentioned earlier. What would you say the major thesis of your book is? It, beyond just the Garrison case itself, what do you want people to get out of this book?
Well, you know, it's kind of fun for somebody like me who has a hobby of the JFK assassination. It's kind of fun, you know. You can spend years reading conspiracy books and thinking about it and writing about it, and it's a fun hobby for a lot of people. The problem is that it can turn murderous and turn deadly when a public official gets into office and believes in some of these conspiracy theories. And Garrison is a good case of not only going after Clay Shaw or Edgar Eugene Bradley, but I mean, I tell the story of Carlos Bringuier, who was an anti-Castro Cuban. His wife was so afraid of him being arrested, she had a miscarriage. And so there's an awful lot of casualties of a Jim Garrison. And so it's a warning to society that we should not. We need to know more about our elected officials. We need to have avenues to get rid of elected officials who display horrific conspiracy theories, because it will lead to a lot of problems.
I guess I do have one bone to pick. And that's, you are sort of coming at things, or politically you are more on the conservative end of things. And I know you make references in the book to Oliver Stone's, I think you refer to it as postmodern leftism, the irrational leftism of Jim Garrison. And I think, you know, there were leftists, pretty prominent ones, that have pushed back on the Kennedy assassination conspiracy theories. For instance, Chip Berlay, who I had on recently, Noam Chomsky, Alexander Coburn. So I'm wondering, do you think it's just a problem of leftism? Was that what you were sort of getting at, or not?
No, and I think in the 1960s, it was a leftist problem. All of the early JFK researchers were extreme, somewhat crazy lefties. Of course, that's changed. Now you have Roger Stone and other people on the right. Some of those libertarian groups that you see, Lou Rockwell, who have embraced the JFK assassination. So now it was the left. Now it's also the right that is using the JFK. And I always say the JFK assassination is like the Rosetta Stone of conspiracy theories, because now anybody can use it to explain anything. If you want to explain the military-industrial complex, you can use the JFK assassination. If you want to explain the Vietnam War, if you want to explain the CIA, the deep state, you name it, you could use the assassination.
Well, I think another big criticism you can make with conspiracy theories. And I mean, to be clear, you know, I think conspiracies do happen. I'm pretty convinced that there was probably cover-ups of maybe intelligence failures when it came to something like 9/11. I'm not saying that not like an inside job thing, but intelligence failures. Yeah. I could see that happening. But the thing with conspiracy theories is if you're a person that wants to like challenge power, I don't think that it ends up really changing anything, right? It doesn't really lead to reform. And I think conspiracy theorists get into this mindset where they think if we can just expose the conspiracy and get these bad people out of power that have been leading the cover-up for all these years and who are behind the initial conspiracy, then we'll fix everything. And yeah. I'm very adamant, even with my friends who believe there was a conspiracy in the JFK assassination, that I think that is a completely wrongheaded view to take.
Yeah, I'll say two things on that. Of course, you're right. And I think some people see the JFK assassination as sort of a primary cause. Every problem we have today traces back to the JFK assassination. But the second point I want to make is I do think there was a cover-up in the JFK assassination. I think there were a lot of cover-ups. The CIA had to cover up at the time that they were working with the mob, anti-Castro Cubans, to get rid of Castro. They had to cover that up. The FBI covered up the fact that Oswald left a note at FBI headquarters, an angry note. They tore that up and flushed it down the toilet. The Secret Service covered up. There were a lot of cover-ups of what was going on at the time, but they weren't covering up a conspiracy. They were covering up their own mishigas or problems that they had to hide. I'll give you the way I describe this to some of my friends is, you know, when I was 16, 15, my mother, you know, the one wondered if I was smoking. So, you know, I'm going to search your room. I'm going to find evidence maybe you're smoking. And of course, I was very nervous. But I wasn't nervous that she would find evidence that I was smoking. I was worried that she might find my gay magazines. And so that's sort of the cover-up that happened. Cover-ups do happen even when there is no conspiracy.
One last thing I wanted to ask, because I noticed you didn't mention it in the book, and I don't want to speak ill of the dead here because I don't know what his actual views were, but you mentioned Fletcher Prouty was involved with the Liberty Lobby. Someone else we mentioned earlier in the interview was also involved, namely Mark Lane. And I guess Mark Lane would say that he was very much for free speech, so he would defend the Liberty Lobby in cases. What do you make of his relationship to the Liberty Lobby?
Well, Mark Lane actually, for a while, had an anti-Zionist column. He was head of the anti-Zionist group of the Liberty Lobby. So, you know, I mean, it not surprising for the Liberty Lobby to want somebody who is Jewish to be the anti-Zionist guy in the organization. Look, it sort of fits with Mark Lane's political views. And, you know, somebody actually does need to write a whole book about Mark Lane. There's a lot of fascinating material about the man.
He was there at Jonestown.
He was everywhere. He was, you know, Mother Jones ran a great article about him, which you could find online called the Left's Hearse Chaser. He was a hearse chaser. The Martin Luther King assassination. For a while, he was James Earl Ray's lawyer. He was everywhere. Where there was headlines to have, he was there. A really awful man in many ways.
Well, closing out here, is there anything that you want to add? I know some of my listeners are probably not going to like this particular interview.
Well, I just, you know, I say what really saddens me is that people who believe in conspiracy get so angry with me. And every day on Facebook, you know, when I post stuff from my blog on Garrison, I mean, I get so many insults and angry comments. And I wish people would calm down a bit. Let's debate this stuff. Let's be calm. No need for insults. It's not like God has come down on one side or the other. These are a lot of the stuff is very debatable issues where we should have a robust debate. And it should be calm and measured. With no angst and anger. And that's my I hope people will do that.
Well, hey, Fred Litwin, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views to discuss your book, On the Trail of Delusion. Jim Garrison, the Great Accuser. I think this has been a really fascinating conversation, and I hope listeners have enjoyed our conversation.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Fred Litwin, author of On the Trail of Delusion. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Ben, Catherine, Brian, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.